Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. Some of our most acclaimed novelists got their start writing for stage and screen, but each medium presents different thrills and challenges. In this session, Finnegan Crookmeyer, Jane Harrison, and Jordan Prosso discuss what happens when acclaimed playwrights become novelists with host La Trobe's Dr. Carrie Tiffany. Please note, some of these live events may contain strong language. I hope you enjoy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Bendigo Writers Festival today. I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're gathered here on unceded Dja-Dja-Wurrung and Tungurung country and to pay my respects to all First Nations people, to elders past and present. This session is called From Stage to Page, and we generally refer to the Greeks as the first dramatists, but Aboriginal culture is the oldest living culture in the world, a culture rich with song and story, so that really can't be right anymore, can it? My name is Carrie Tiffany. I'm a novelist and I'm a lecturer in English and Creative Writing at La Trobe University, and this session is proudly presented by La Trobe University, and it's being recorded for the Literary La Trobe podcast. There were 17 sessions at Bendigo Writers Festival last year that were presented as part of that podcast, and you can listen to them on Spotify and Apple and all those other places as well. So we'll soon be up there too. So let me introduce our fabulous panel today. Can I introduce Jane Harrison? Jane is descended from the Murawari people of New South Wales. She is an award-winning playwright and author. Her play, The Visitors, premiered at Sydney Festival in 2020 in a sold-out season. And her first play, Stolen, which I suspect some of you will have seen, has played across Australia and internationally for 7 years. Jane's YA novel, which I have here, Becoming Kiralee Lewis, won the 2014 Black and Right Prize and was shortlisted for the Prime Minister's Literary Awards and the Victorian Premier's Awards. Jane is currently, but has just left her position as the Artistic Director of the Black and Bright First Nations Literary Festival. She's been there since 2016 doing fantastic things. And we're here to talk about her most recent novel, which is called The Visitors. It's a very beautiful novel here. Now, you might not know this from looking at Jane today, although I think there are hints, but she used to be a punk and she used to ride a motorbike and she used to have blue hair. And I can actually see a kind of punk aesthetic in this book, I reckon. It is a total mashup novel in the most unexpected and really interesting ways. Far over there on the end, we have Finnegan Crookmeyer. Finnegan was born in Ireland. When he was 5 years of age, he sang All Along the Watchtower with Jimi Hendrix's bass player Noel Redding in an Irish pub. Now, I understand that's not unusual. That happens to pretty much all Irish kids, but he wanted to tell us about it anyway for some reason. Finn lives in Adelaide. He is an award-winning playwright and his works have been performed on 6 continents. And in 8 languages. I believe he has written 104 plays. He's an overachiever. He's received many awards, 42 of them, including the 2017 Mickey Miner's Lifetime Achievement Award, Award for Services to International Theatre for Young Audiences, and the 2015 David Williamson Prize for Excellence in Writing for Australian Theatre. In 6 days, Finn will attempt to run his first ever marathon. If we were in a more intimate session, I suspect we should ask him to stand up and maybe we could assess his physique and whether maybe we could put bets on whether or not he whether or not he's going to succeed. But you can take out private bets on whether you think Finn will get over the line or not, okay? And lastly, Finn, please hold up your book because you've got my copy. So this is his beautiful book here. Lastly, can I introduce in the middle Jordan Prosser? Jordan is a playwright, a screenwriter, a filmmaker and a performer from Victoria. He's a graduate of the VCA and his short films and screenplays have won multiple international accolades. His short story, Eleuterio Cabrera's Beautiful Game, which is also in part of this wonderful novel, won the Peter Carey Short Story Award in 2022 and was published in Mianjin. This novel, Big Time, this big novel, Big Time, is his first novel. I understand that Jordan's also famous for other things. He had a line of dialogue in Happy Feet 2. Now, I have done my due diligence and read the books, but I didn't watch the film. But I do understand all the characters are penguins.
Correct.
And are you prepared to speak penguin for us?
Well, I was basically, it's one of Elijah Wood's character's lines. So I was just speaking as Elijah Wood, as a penguin. And the line is, come on. But I get a royalty check for $17 every quarter. So, yeah.
It's not even, were you thinking about a penguin as you said it? Doesn't.
Oh, yeah,
I
you
just,
have to fully
get...
visualize, you know, immerse yourself in penguin.
Okay, all right, okay. This session today is about, it's called Stage to Page. So our three writers have this background and experience in writing for performance. So I want to ask them, of course, the initial most obvious question, which is why the novel? It's not the first novel for Jane, but for Jordan and for Finn it is. So I'm really interested in what made you decide to do this. As if one is not difficult enough, you must change lanes and do this as well. So please.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for coming along. I've enjoyed a really lovely and lucky kind of 20-year career writing plays, primarily to commission, and so that's been a job that has felt very satisfying in lots of ways, and the collegiality of theatre has always been a great pleasure, and existing in that world and writing what is essentially half of a work and then having other artists fill it out and bring it to life and realise it is a gift. But always there was this niggling other kind of yearning in my head, and I thought back to what led me to fall in love with words and stories and art, and it was books. Books have always been this lovely, intimate pleasure, which whenever I'm afforded a moment of solitude or just, you know, wanting to partake in art in a very kind of quiet, personal way, it's always entailed taking a book down off a shelf. And so I thought, what would it be like to write a story of my own one day and put it on a shelf through this amazing process which text made possible. And so, yeah, the moment in time arose. I waited for permission for a long time. I was kind of applying for funding and the funders said, no, you're a playwright. They kind of didn't help out. And then in these wild 2 months where life kind of called it into being, there was a kind of a near tragedy in my house. My then wife got very sick, and so she hibernated for a year, and our world became very small and very intimate. And within that time, I needed to be doing something which wasn't dealing with the complexities of this moment in time. And it became a book just pouring out. And so it wrote itself, essentially. It was a crazy, unfurling thing.
Beautiful. Thank you. Jordan.
For me, I grew up sort of trying to be an actor and then segued into theatre, mostly writing and devising like very large-scale sort of promenade performance stuff. And then film stole my heart and I studied that. And so I worked for, you know, decade and a half as a screenwriter. And then it really wasn't actually until COVID that I picked this book up. I'd started writing it in 2014 because I'd simply always wanted to write a novel. I grew up writing prose and short stories. And so I'd written the first few chapters about 10 years ago, and then it just, you know, sat on my computer. And then it was the second half of 2021 when in Melbourne we were thrown back into our sort of longest and bleakest lockdown. And of course, I'd been waiting 18 months basically for the film industry to pick itself up again after, you know, all productions were shut down, like everything was sort of halted. It was incredibly grim. People were just fleeing the industry. And I'd had this, you know, corporate job that had sustained me throughout lockdowns, and I'd quit in June 2021 being like, haha, you know, we will return triumphant to the cinemas. And then about 2 weeks later, we went back into 120 days of lockdown. So really out of pure desperation and not being sure whether I would ever get to write a film or get a film made. And because everyone was saying at the time, oh, Shakespeare wrote King Lear during the plague, you know, which was not that helpful.
Was everyone really saying that?
No, well, they were to me. I thought, well, to hell with it. I'll do something that I can do on my own. I don't need to step onto a set. I don't need to be in a writer's room. So it was really kind of out of a desperate need for some sort of personal creative expression. It was sort of a balm, like, I suppose not dissimilar to your situation where it was like life had shrunk down to being very, very small. And that just felt like the opportune moment to pick up something which is a very, very singular, very, very lonely, but very focused sort of creative endeavor. And that's, yeah, something good came of that really awful time.
And you must have been continuing to write the book even after the lockdown, though. So it had enough impetus then that...
Yes, yeah. It did. As you mentioned, I won the Peter Carey Short Story Award, and the book was half written. And the short story that won that prize is a standalone chapter in the book. So I was lucky enough that when my publisher Aviva at UQP sort of came asking, oh, can I read your short story? What else have you got? I was fortunate enough to be able to say, well, I've quite a bit here. This is the first half of a book. And she loved it and told me to write the second half.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks, Jordan. Jane, your story is a bit different because The Visitors was already this very, very successful play. And I haven't seen this happen in that direction very much, that a play becomes a novel.
Yeah. Well, actually, it wasn't a successful play at that stage when I started writing it, because I started writing it in 2011, and I had a number of workshops up at Yellamundi, up in New South Wales, and MTC shortlisted it 2 years in a row and kept saying, we're going to do it next year, we're going to do it next year. And then in the end, they said to me, we don't think we can sell 13,000 seats. So that was it. It's not a good play or... whatever. So I despaired that it would ever get produced. And it was a play about seven Aboriginal men, and men weren't popular during that era. Plays about men weren't being staged. There was much more a push for female-centred stories to be on our stages, and female directors as well. And so I thought, it's not going to be performed. Why don't I write a book version? Because I'm more likely to get it published than I am get it performed. And then during that process of writing the book, it actually had its first production at Sydney Festival in 2020. So, but it had its momentum then. But then, of course, COVID happened and it didn't tour. There were no, you know, options for it to be restaged. And so it had a bit of a lull. And then in 2023 last year, yeah, we're still in 2024, it was a new production at the Sydney Opera House. And so by that time, of course, the book was being published.
Wow.
I had the book published at the end of August. I had the play on at the Opera House in September, and I had the opera on at the Playhouse in October.
You covered all of the bases. That's fantastic.
Pretty much. So, the film is yet to come.
Yeah. So were people going to watch the play and then immediately reading the book, or the other way around as well?
And yeah, I think it's been a little bit both ways. You know, a number of people have seen the play and then have bought the book, and then, of course, plays don't go everywhere, so it's actually touring at the moment. I think it's in northern New South Wales at the moment, the play. Some people come to the book first.
I haven't seen the play. I want it to come to Melbourne. Can it come to Melbourne?
Well, it had actually, it was in Bendigo. Did anyone see it in Bendigo?
Oh
great. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yes, it went to Bendigo, went to Wangaratta, Frankston, yeah. Nunawading,
yeah.
But not in the CBD.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thanks, Jane. When I think about writers who've bridged this gap, this divide successfully, and I think I really love the Irish writer Sebastian Barry, who I came to his fiction through his plays. I'm thinking about people like Sam Shepard, who I'm really pretty crazy about as a playwright and as a short story writer and novelist. Deborah Levy, most recently in Australia, Leah Purcell. But there's a lot of really great novelists who've written, frankly, pretty ordinary plays. And there's a lot of great playwrights that have written pretty ordinary novels. So it's not always successful. And when we think about, you know, some of the major double dealers like Beckett, you know, he wrote plays that read like novels and novels that read like plays. So he's in the same sort of camp, really. It's just kind of language and its expression. And I was also thinking of Chekhov, of course, and some of his short stories. And this opening of At a Country House, his beautiful short story, At a Country House. So this opening, Paul Rasevich paced up and down, stepping softly on the rug-covered floor. Well, that could be a stage direction for a play, couldn't it? So what have we got there? We've got someone walking about in their house. We've got a kind of metaphorical curtain rising on this bit of prose, on this bit of fiction. So as I was reading these novels, I was kind of reading them, waiting to experience this metaphorical curtain rising of the story beginning. I was really alert for it. But all of the novels begin in very vivid place. Jordan's begins on a, is it a Qantas flight? An Air New Zealand flight, yeah, on an Air New Zealand flight, a very kind of daggy kind of beginning on it, you know, all the things we experience about, you know, that international travel. He's kind of chatting with the air host, what do we call him? He's a steward. Finn's begins on a boat. It's out at sea. And it's very kind of mythical and strange and kind of rugged. And Jane's begins with a young man from the Eora Nation waking up and going out fishing. So they're very confident in their setting and in their description. And I wanted to know how you manage that shift so seamlessly. And you sort of, there's no curtain, you know, there's just this kind of sense of place and setting and character all enmeshed and kind of moving together, all with all that kind of propulsive narrative that you want in a novel.
One of the things, I was writing the opera at the same time I was writing the novel, and of course the opera was, I was given the instruction to slash it down to 15 pages and to only write the big scenes. Well, that was quite easy. Slashing is easy. Editing down and distilling the story was quite easy. The challenge for me was to write the novel to take 15,000 words to 65,000 words. And so I think you can see the play throughout the novel, but of course it gave me the freedom to write description. And as playwrights, we don't generally write description. It's frowned upon and directors don't like it. So that gave me the chance to write about the setting and the country, and I think country is a really big theme throughout this story. I read a lot of the accounts of the First Fleet, and they were quite expansive on the wildlife and the plants and the animals and things like that, the bird life, much more than they were about the Aboriginal people. So there wasn't a huge amount of content that I could find in there about Aboriginal people. So I had to invent that myself based on my own kind of lived experience. But the countryside, yeah, so I put those descriptions of the birds and the plants and the, the fish life throughout the book, and I won't say padded it out, but it gave me, I had things to write in between the kind of scenes of the play that I could write, the story of them getting to the meeting place. The basic story, for those of you who don't know it, it's the arrival of the First Fleet, but from the perspective of the First Nations people, so set in 1788. And I have my seven Aboriginal people arriving at this destination where they are meeting to decide what their response will be to the First Fleet.
Thanks, Jane. I thought the ecological knowledge as well, like the enmeshed First Nations ecological knowledge, which can't have come from the First Fleet accounts because they wouldn't have known that information. It's just kind of so rich with that knowledge too, yeah, and beautifully described.
Yeah, I did a deep dive when I was researching the novel. It required a lot more research than the play did. And so I looked at different, you know, bush foods and how they were used traditionally and, you know, just knowledge about how to build the canoes. For example, just a little detail from the book, the canoe for a naui is traditional name, in that they cut the bark off the tree. Well, you'd think that it would take the shape of the tree, that natural shape, but in fact they steam it, and so the smooth side of the bark is on the outside so it can move through the water faster. And just little details like that I found really intriguing. They had to be linked to the characters though, so they had to be embedded with their cultural knowledge. Otherwise it was just exposition, just me doing my research and throwing it in.
One thing I noticed a lot when I was writing was a sort of a fear, I suppose, that I felt in myself, because I think there is this growing, maybe it's been there a while, a definite suspicion of writers who have clearly written a book purely for the objective of getting it optioned and made into a film. And so being a screenwriter myself, I knew that was, a likely accusation that I would come up against, people being like, he's just trying to get it made into a film. Because you do read books sometimes that almost feel like the novelization of a movie just done in reverse. But then, so I would catch myself writing it being like, does that read too much like big print in a script? Does that read too much like a stage direction? And I kind of just taught myself, I think, to let go of that a little bit, because I think the really discrete distinctions between, say, like stage, film, book, I think they're blurring, they're slipping a lot more than they ever have. Stories move between those mediums much more fluidly than they ever have. And I actually only think that's a net good. Like, I think people will get very different things out of your book to, say, your play, from your opera. You know, it shouldn't necessarily be that one is kind of the be-all, end-all and the others are somehow secondary to that. So, you know, I think sometimes you'll read a review or someone talking about a book and it'll say it's very cinematic and it's kind of being leveled as a criticism. But I think you just have to embrace it simply because that's how I think and that's how I write, you know, and instead you hope that saying something is cinematic simply means that it's been rendered quite richly and visually. So, yeah, I think it's as much about your own sort of perspective on your writing as it is about, you know, what people are taking away from it.
What about the actual writing into place, though? Because you do manage that, like everything is evoked very, very richly and it feels grounded. And it does feel like there's enough time for everything as well, that you're not kind of rushing across. The story's not kind of dragging you across. So are you a kind of footstepper? Were you going around, you know, actually sort of seeing, pulling information that you might bring
yes,
into the book?
A lot. I started the book in 2014, which is when I went on this great trip, sort of round the world trip, the gap year I'd never had. And a lot of the places in the book, especially there are these vignette chapters that sort of take place in Scotland and South America and Japan. And it's, you know, I drew a lot on my experiences traveling and going to those places. And then other than that, just in terms of realizing them, I probably drew more, I think, on my experience as a director too, where you're not just in control of the words and the story, but in control of the lighting and the costumes and the sets. And if you can picture that clearly enough and then find the right way to describe it with language, then, you know, that's sort of my go-to method, I think.
Mm. And Finn, your book, it's the generation, is it six generations, isn't it?
Yeah.
We have a lot of time, but we also have, most of this is happening in the same place. And so that's kind of very interesting to see that place peopled and the connection between those people. But the place is also described in such a kind of way, and there's repetition of some buildings that change. A hospital might become a prison, in different generations. But I had, by the end of it, a very strong sense of a kind of where this was. Mm. I was actually wondering if it is somewhere that you have lived, the way that it was evoked. Yeah,
it's not. No, my epiphany felt kind of kindred to what you were talking about, Jane, in terms of this permission, this lovely permission, knowing I was sitting down to a book and something which wasn't so kind of helmed by the humans I was populating a place with. I've always done that with theatre. I've always kind of met the character first, heard what they want to say, heard what the imposition might be or deduced that, seen who the antagonists or protagonists or helpers or hindrances to that journey might be and kind of built out accordingly. It's a population of humans that exist and explain the story to me. And with this, I found what was happening over and over was this sense of arrival. And they were all landing in a place. And like you, I've never given that much scrutiny to place as a character in its own right. And the way that place then informs the characters who populate it, and even the way that they perceive the same thing. So this forest, this building, this hill, this jetty, this main street, it kind of is encumbered by everybody who bears witness to it or moves through it in their own way. It becomes something which is told, because essentially it's a story about stories. It's a story about the things we tell ourselves and the way that those stories are then passed down to other generations, or the way you tell a landscape what it might be or what it might be needed for, and then it kind of finds a way to become that for you. It's kind of this self-reflecting prophecy and mythologizing. There's a lot of that happening in the piece. So I kind of just lent into it. I just thought, okay, this is a wholly different exercise for me. I will play this game and I will enjoy this game and I will kind of, colour this landscape as much as I need to until it feels totally known to me as the writer of it. And that's lovely to hear that then the next jump occurred where somebody reading would feel a sense of affinity or a sense of knowing of it.
I love that idea that the story is in the landscape and you kind of come along with a shovel and sort of dig it up, that it's there first and uncovering it rather than creating it and putting it on top.
First there's a real literalism to it, which is the sense of a founder who does craft a community from what he takes to be nothing. He thinks that he's the builder of it. But then what becomes apparent is that there are birds, there are populations who have existed in this place longer than him, and part of his settling into and making peace with the landscape is acknowledging that we are not the creators of these spaces. They manifest us as well. And it becomes a conversation.
Well, these novels are all very idiosyncratic, and I think that if Finn and Jordan and Jane hadn't had a performance writing background, it would have been impossible to throw a blanket over them and say you're all going together. So I've been trying to find sort of something thematic, some links in the books as I was reading them. And one of them I could find is that they all have really fascinating approaches to time. Jordan, the most directly, of course, his novel is called Big Time, and it involves the taking of certain drugs that drastically alter your experience of time. We want to check with Jordan where we can get hold of these things after the session. The novels are also sort of, they're all anti-realist, I think. They're fables, they're dystopian, they're mythic. Jane's novel is about an event that we know happened in the past, but it's narrated in her novel in the present tense. And she does this really interesting thing with time. We're thinking, Invasion Day, big drama, and we think, well, the drama is the kind of landing and what happens next. But no, Jane completely turns our expectations for that on its head and expands time in just a very short period leading up to that event. So what we see is this kind of long before through these particular characters, these seven characters. It's a really interesting approach. And she makes those hours leading up to the invasion much more vital than the event itself. So very Very interesting approach. So, Jane, I wanted you to talk about that a little bit, about why you decided to do that, why you decided to expand. You're both kind of compressing and expanding, actually. You're focusing just on this particular meeting. And I tell you, it's a very bureaucratic meeting. It's like, it reminded me of a kind of municipal council meeting, like the agreement, you know, some of these men are total pedants, aren't they? You know, the protocols, you know, it's like the minute taking and the agreement and the consensus. Yeah. It's really fascinating. But I'd love to hear a bit about why this idea occurred to you, and also get you to read a little bit for us too.
Okay. So time, I wanted to pay homage to the idea of Aboriginal time being the past, the present and the future coexisting together. So that's why I put it in the present tense, because I think even though it's something that happened, you know, 200 years odd years ago, it still lives in our bodies as Aboriginal people. Colonisation, you know, hasn't gone away, and it's still, you know, manifesting in a lot of, trauma. But this is the period before that event, and so it's a period of innocence. And I kind of wanted to show those men in that period of innocence before they got kind of corrupted. You can feel the corruption coming in, the strange weather events, and the animals and the birds are behaving weirdly. A parrot falls dead at one of the men's feet. And it's kind of like an omen for things to come. The clouds are very strange and unusual as well. It was just about that period of innocence before colonisation actually happened. And I guess my whole idea for this this story was to, you know, colonisation is something that happened to Aboriginal people, and it's not empowering. There's no sense of it being empowering at all, even though, you know, Jacinta Price might say that we got things out of colonisation. I think most Aboriginal people wouldn't agree with that as a discourse. And so I thought that's not very empowering for Aboriginal people, but what if I could write something where my characters had agency and made a choice, and based on their traditional protocols about welcoming to country. I mean, we've all been to a welcome to country. We've all heard a welcome to country. And they're so generous. Like, that's what I can't understand. After all the events of colonisation, how you can get an elder saying, you are welcome to this country from the tops of the trees to the roots of the trees. We ask only this of you, that you look after the children of this country and you look after the land of the country. I think that's such an act of generosity, and I wanted to kind of imbue the book with that sense of generosity and agency, so that they had a choice. They didn't know the consequences. I mean, in the book I go further than the play, and I have a coda in there that talks about the events 18 months after the arrival, and it's not a pretty ending to the story, but I felt that was needed in the book form, and so that's it. I don't know whether I answered your question, but
can you read a little for us, Jane?
Oh, yes, yeah. Sure. I'll just read the prologue. Gadalung marble season, the hot time. Wongal country, red sky in the morning, and, sorry, my eyesight is not great. And although it is after dawn, the air is already searing Grandfather Joseph's lungs. Above him, the cloud formation is rare. Breast-like bulges pattern the sky, mammatus clouds. Suddenly, a scarlet parakeet falls dead at his feet. Today will be most unusual, he thinks, weather-wise and animal-wise. They are interlinked. He squats down to examine the bird, its plumage vivid before looking up at the sky. He plucks a tail feather from its still warm body and places it in his hair. What does it all mean? What is about to happen?
Well, Jordan, I don't want to give too much away about time in your novel, beautifully called Big Time, but I was interested in this. I love this literal play on the idea of tripping. Mm. So tripping as in you're moving forward,
yes,
but tripping as in your novel, you're seeing something of the future. Mm. And some people are more empowered in this ability to see further or not quite so far into the future. But then there's something meta happening in the novel in that it is also set in the future, in that it's set in a dystopian Australia. So tell us about time.
Yeah. So the F... This brand new drug, which is applied to the eyeballs and lets you see a certain level into the future, depends how party fit you are, basically. You know, like depends on your tolerance, your body chemistry, as with any other sort of, you know, drug or substance. So the rumor says, you know, the more you take, the further you're able to see. So of course, people are almost competing now to see how much of the future they can take in. But yes, as you say, at the same time, there are these kind of destabilizing effects on a global scale, people noticing time loops and these extreme coincidences which seem to be sort of undermining this omnidirectional flow of time that we're so used to. And so really that ability to kind of jump ahead and jump back, that's really why I kind of always knew it had to be a book, not rather than anything else, rather than a play or rather than a film. I think the one of the greatest powers in novel is the elasticity of time. Your ability to kind of like speed up as fast as you can and then suddenly stop and roll back, you know. Like stage plays can be so limited, like the power is in their immediacy, I think. And film, to my thinking, is actually surprisingly bad at conveying the passage of time. That's why you end up with so many hokey montages, because all you can really do is find a good way to cut through time. But, you know, for a book, and all of ours do it, I think, you can zoom in and you know, spend an entire page describing a single thought or second, or you can zoom all the way out and skip over a century, you know. And the way that you move through time... in a literary sense, like thinking about your coda, for instance, you know, the entire book is set over the course of this one day, and then suddenly you speed up and you cover a number of years, I believe, and you really feel that sudden acceleration. Like it's almost like whiplash inducing because you've been so used to one particular time frame, and then suddenly you're off, and suddenly you're in the future, and then suddenly you're in the here and now. So yeah, I think that, yeah, like I said, the elasticity, like how the flexibility with time and the control that you have over it, I think is one of my favorite things about books in general, and one of the reasons why I wanted to write this story as one.
Mm. I was as I was reading your novel, I was sort of teaching a class, and I was talking to my fiction writers about just be really careful with coincidence. You know, coincidence is not a good idea. The reader is very alert to too much coincidence. Yeah. And then I'm reading your novel and thinking, you know, clearly everything is up for grabs, yes, in exciting ways. But read us a little.
Sure. I'll just read a little snippet from a section early on in the book, when the rock band at the center of the story have retreated to a renovated church in the Belgrave rainforest to record their second album.
Does this include some of the song titles?
No, it doesn't.
The song titles are hilarious. So,
and there's been tensions have been running high over the creative direction of the album. Julian doesn't say much during the recording sessions after that. He shows up at 10, stands in his spot, and plays what he's told to. There are no jam sessions or lyrics brainstorms. There's certainly no room for improvisation. Ash drills bars with individual band members until he's satisfied. Other times he halts the session and storms over to sit with Solomon and Nat, listening to a particular riff or melody on a loop before storming back from the nave and covering the band's sheet music with large black crosses and penciled-in semiquavers. Good practice for when we're out on our asses taking session gigs, Tammy says with a sigh one afternoon, shooting pool in the green room with Julian. Days often stretch into the early hours of the morning. Skinner brings pastries for breakfast, sushi for lunch, pizza for dinner, and for some inexplicable fucking reason, at about 11:30 each and every night, he puts together an exquisite charcuterie board teeming with grapes and figs and cheese and cured meats. The board inevitably sits collecting flies and condensation before being stashed away in the lacto fridge upstairs. The church also features a busy rotating roster of friends, lovers, and collaborators. I'm there a fair bit, getting a head start on a puff piece band profile commissioned by Deadbeat, the FREA's sole remaining music magazine. Cleo's there from time to time just to talk shit and raid the kitchen. If the charcuterie ever disappeared overnight, I could guarantee I'd find it back at my place the next day, all the cheese eaten, but the figs untouched. And while Julian and some of the others had been on the fence vis-a-vis the church, Ludlow is in love with it. They're there 3 or 4 days a week, getting shots for my article and a hardback making-of coffee table book that the label plans to release to coincide with the album. Buzzing through the space with their old Nikon whirring, drinking in the mottled light, the scaffolding and the candle holders, the yellow roof and the eerie depth of it all. Ludlow produces a frankly stunning series of oddly Baroque band portraits, documenting week 1, week 3, week 5, week 10, and so on, marking the band's hairstyles changing, their roots growing out, their nail polish chipping, muscles popping out from under tank tops as they shed any excess weight, oily sweat beading on unkempt stubble, and the persistent looks of grim concentration as Xander and Julian and Tammy make the daily attempt to wrap their heads around Ash's new musical vision, which includes aspects of jazz, soul, hardcore, math rock, kawaii core, and folktronica, sometimes all within the same song. The tougher the session, the finer the photographs. Tammy, in particular, has never seen herself captured quite like that. She stares at Ludlow's proof sheets for a very long time, silently undergoing some sort of radiant self-reappraisal.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. I'm probably showing my age here, but as I was reading those sections in the church, I was thinking, it's a Chelsea Hotel in Belgrave.
100%.
Fantastic. Finn, I was trying to think about how to describe time in your book. I was thinking, how do I describe this? It's sort of like playing an accordion and somebody's kind of opening and closing the accordion, and bits of this kind of air is getting out and floating through this really interesting landscape. So all of these connections across these six generations of characters. So it's a very impressive act of composition. There's so much up in the air, you know, there's so much being, so many threads that are coming through. So was this a big planning or did you just kind of write it in a linear fashion or...
I'm not a planner. I never have been a planner. Despite my Teutonic surname as a crookemeyer, I just throw myself into the ether. And so each bit kind of wrote itself as it needed to be written. And then I would kind of sit down to the task the next day and decide what felt right, what I wanted to encounter in this next sitting. And with those, again, permissions came this... ability to jump through time as I needed or go back and forwards. And I realised something I love about moving through time is the way that we can get to know a character and then reappraise them. You look at them a different way because they meant so many wonderful things to somebody who was their peer. But as a grandparent, you know, they carry so much baggage or something like that. And by just giving the reader these permissions to kind of assess and then reassess the same characters over and over again, it felt like it was adding to layers of complexity and just subtext to characters, kind of riching them out a bit. At the launch, I was talking about it, and I said that I kind of realised that because it has a fable or a moral element to it, a moral tale, a morality tale, I kind of judged a lot of the characters as I was writing them, and then what I was happy to discover was that I misjudged a lot of the characters as I was writing them, that they proved themselves better or worse or different or purer or more sullied or whatever it was, and I just lent into each of those permissions.
Fabulous. Can you read for us?
Yeah, sure. This harbourside town is a place of arrivals, and somebody turns up one night, a man on a bicycle, and kind of enters into the life of a woman who is waiting for love or the permission for children or a next step in her life to occur, and the two kind of find their way to each other. So this is his nocturnal arrival. He arrived as all slept on a Sunday night, on a bicycle laden with wicker crates and hidden beneath a tilted hat, smelling of a sipping liquor swigged, if strength of stench was any guessing. As he rode through the town, he sang a truly beautiful song, and the sleeping ones in bed sighed happy as it climbed inside their dreams. The riding got slower, and eventually inertia had its way. The bicycle tipped and settled its passenger in the gutter. A wise man would have laughed then at the silliness of such a thing. The man laughed. He climbed out from beneath his bike, then fixed his hat, which had landed straight back to its sloping angle, and staggered to an alleyway. "Stay," he told the bicycle. Then laughed, then hiccuped, then slid down the wall as tiredness placed a caring hand upon his shoulder and bade him go to ground. collapsed in the shadows, he said a silent prayer of thanks that was to no single God, but rather all of them at once. Forgetting him through another day and smiling at the stars, he slept. He was not meant for children. One time after another he had said it, but still the thought came to him often in his dreams. The sunlight was a cruel thing as it cut across the man's eyelids. Muttering some words that were for no God to be hearing, he lifted himself and glanced down the alley. There stood his bicycle, no longer in the gutter, but now leant carefully against a lamppost. And from this simple repositioning, the man understood that this was a town that gave itself to the writing of falling things, and he knew he would linger here a while.
Thank you, Ben. Beautiful. The other thematic link for me is humour. So, Jane, you wouldn't think a book ostensibly about first contact could be funny, but it is. It's full of kind of gossip and dad jokes. It's got dad jokes in it. And it's just so kind of charming in some of its humour. It was really, you know, really delightful. Finn's humour, I think, is quite different. There's an embittered character who is a trickster in his book. And there's a kind of glee that the reader experiences when this person sort of gets their comeuppance in some ways. So it's a different kind of humour, but it's definitely there. And Jordan's is it's a ride, like it's a kind of rollicking subculture. As I said, the titles of some of the songs are frankly hilarious, I'm sure. And the band is called The Acceptables. It's just yeah, there has to, you now have to form a band called The Acceptables. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about that. There's some kind of energy in all of you that that is expressed here, and there's a lot of kind of delight and energy. And Jane's is just so unexpected for me. Yeah,
a book about colonisation with jokes. I'm not a funny person. I'm the only Aboriginal person I know who doesn't have a sense of humour. But I love writing a line that will get a laugh from, when an actor delivers it. And so I get the show reports of the visitors' play at the moment, and I love going down to say, this line, you know, got a laugh from the audience, or this line hit the spot tonight. I love that. And I just think it's so important for First Nations storytelling to have that sense of humour, because I think we've used humour as a tool to overcome, you know, a lot of disadvantage and a lot of trauma. And, whenever you get a bunch of Aboriginal people together, there'll be laughter and jokes. And so I really wanted to, lean into that. And yeah, I like a pun as well. There's a few lines in there like curiosity killed the echidna and middens weren't built in a day, that I would really like to come into popular parlance.
Wouldn't that be fantastic? Take them on. Now on, everyone has to say that. Okay.
Middens weren't built in a day.
Fantastic. Thanks, Jane.
I think...
Can you give us some of the song titles?
Oh, okay. Let me find them. Hang on.
I think I might have had a page turn there, where it is.
No, you can talk about your book.
I always worry, like, if, and in plays as well that I write, like when you're getting too close to earnestness, how to undercut that moment. You know, whatever seems to be the dominant or prevailing feeling of a moment, how to then give it a new take. So take something that seems like it's full of levity and then drop the truth in, or you know, similarly, like, establish a character as really heavy and intense and then push her into the sea with a knowing wink. Like, you know, do whatever you need to do. And so these characters, and because it's a lot of people turning up in the same place, it is a lot of people sizing each other up and seeing culturally how they exist and where they butt up against each other. And so, like, Emma the Greek is such a weird, strange oddity, like a pleasure of a character to write. She was so fun and so rude with her boobs out and just, like, doing what she wanted and having her way with a gent she loved and just being wild and crazy and leaning into things. And so I liked the lightness she brought. So I just let her do what she needed to, and then I giggled coquettishly as she did crazy things.
That comes across. Thank you. Yeah.
the band in my book sort of got famous off making this very kind of piecemeal, radio-friendly pop music with names like How You Move Me, What Time Is Your Heart, Blueberry Afternoons, Good Problem to Have, What Time Is Your Heart, Reprise. And then they transitioned to sort of really transgressive punk music with names like Boot to the Neck, Fuck Panic, War Drums, Apathy Headache, Puppet People, and Misanthropotopia. But I think that it's meant to be satirizing, you know, bands who try and have that complete identity, you know, that whole reinvention. I think like the North Star for me for this book and for a lot of my writing is Kurt Vonnegut, particularly Slaughterhouse-Five, which I think is such brilliant satire, because it is a book that's about, you know, war crimes. It's about atrocities, but it also has two naked people trapped in a zoo on an alien planet. It is such a funny book, and I think it just comes down to that thing of, like, if you don't laugh, then you'll cry, right? Like, it's sometimes the only way that you can approach a certain subject matter, as I think all of our books do. Like, you know, rather than confronting it head on in all its horror, you kind of have to find another way into it. And I think humor is probably the best, like the sharpest tool for doing that.
Mm. Very, very sharp satire in the book. Thank you. We time is leaping on. I want some tips on writing dialogue. Okay, I've got you three here. Is my weakness. I'm not good at it, and it freaks me out. You know, I eavesdrop on people all the time. I carry a notebook. I write down things that people say. I read a lot. I look at how dialogue is working in fiction. I do go to plays and I read plays as well. But you know, when you write for performance, you have to convey everything by how people talk and what they say. So how do you write the kind of dialogue in fiction that doesn't need too much introspection or doesn't need too much attribution, which all of you have managed to do? Jane's is a little bit more of the play format in that she uses the character's name and then they speak. So she doesn't ever say he says or he said or anything, which is very kind of present timey, you know, person speech. But it doesn't feel like a play to me. It does really feel like a novel, yeah. Help me.
Tips for writing dialogue. Get rid of the second half of your sentence and the first word. Often they're superfluous, and it just makes it more spoken dialogue when you do that, because when you find you're writing something, it's quite formal. We're used to explaining everything in that. But dialogue, spoken dialogue, misses out a lot of the context of things, and we get it, we understand. We wouldn't say last year when your mother died of cancer, you know, you were in a bad place. You would just say last year, that was terrible, and you'd leave so much of it out, but the reader can, and the audience can pick up on that. So that's my little tip for writers.
Thank you. So lean and fragmentary. Yeah.
I would 100% agree with the first word thing. After I do a first draft, I'll sort of do like a find delete for well, actually, I think, I see, any of those things that we normally use.
I remember.
Yeah, things we use in our actual day-to-day speech, like likes, you know. You know what I mean? You know, these things that pad out our sentences. Just cut through them, I think, and it makes your dialogue so much cleaner and sharper, and brings your word count down. The only other thing, and this is purely because I'm not a naturalist or a realist. Like, you know, I prefer stylized dialogue. That's just my personal preference. For me, I like to imagine that all of my characters have that gift of you know, the saying, the wit of the stairway, when like you have an argument with somebody and you don't know what to say, and then you're halfway down to the door and you're like, why didn't I say that? So I like to imagine that every character has the perfect comeback. You know, these conversations don't need to be like a real life conversation. I like it when everyone's kind of a master conversationalist. So sometimes if a character of mine has a provocation or hurls an insult or asks a question, sometimes I'll literally go away and leave it and give myself time to think of the perfect retort and then come back and put that in.
I think that really shows, because it is so snappy. It's, yeah, you're watching something really exciting unfold. Yeah. Finn, you have a really interesting treatment with attribution, because you're very light on attribution, but you manage to create a sense of people in real time speaking to each other and expressing very important things to each other in realistic dialogue, but through characterization, I think, yeah.
I think I really have enjoyed the game, and I think that's something very much learnt in writing theatre for a long time, of when you need to, being able to move inside somebody's head. I think the internal monologue is always so rich, and it can often be presenting a very different thing from what is presented externally. And a novel as well affords us this lovely ability to hear a thing half said and then have the sentence completed in a way that nobody would be privy to. And those two composite parts are a truth. And just playing with that. And so also between, yeah, characters and moments, I found that I could know what a scene needed to say and then kind of, yeah, dot the knowledge around amongst a whole conversation, a conversation that went seemingly wherever it needed to, knowing that I would get to that kernel within it. And then once you find that, go, okay, how can I polish this off so that it feels directional, it feels poetic, and it feels, without you knowing you're being carried, that there is a point of logic that will be reached, and I will take you there. And it's just the language, it's the character kind of explaining their way there.
Lovely, thank you. Can we just have the slide up for questions? You're going to text me your questions on this mobile phone. Oh, I think there might already be some there. While I look at that, I'm just going to ask you one final question and then we'll have a couple of minutes for questions. But I'm wondering, now that you've written novels, how it's going to change how you write and feel about writing for performance. Like, will it feel more rigorous, you know, more austere now you've been in the forgiving playground of the novel? I know Jane actually has a big deadline for a play. She has to have a play written by the end of September. It is now mid-August. I believe she hasn't started. It's now mid-August. Does anyone has any ideas for her? Perhaps we could stay back and all write the play together afterwards, because I'm anxious for her. Yeah,
I do a lot of procrastination.
Yeah. So please speak to that while I check these.
I think it's hard to give up the freedom of writing description. So that's what I'm fighting with at the moment, that I want to, you know, they have a saying in writing for theatre, show, don't tell. And a book is very much about telling. So you can allow yourself to kind of have their inner dialogue, their inner thoughts in there expressed. And so that's going to be hard to give up, going back to playwriting. But hopefully the old, you know, habits honed over quite a few years will, I'm not prolific like Finnegan, but I've written a few now, so hopefully it'll come back.
I do firmly believe that writing in any medium enhances your work across any other. Like, again, to my point before about, I think this sort of siloed idea of, well, you're a playwright, you're a screenwriter, you're an author or what have you. I think that's breaking down, and that's for the better. You know, I think any book any of us writes will make us a better screenwriter or playwright, and vice versa. I'm kind of looking forward actually to balancing the two.
I think I've been so enamoured by the pleasure of the new. Whatever the thing I was doing before and the thing I'm doing now is, this thing of changing tack has been so liberating and so epiphanous that I'm still very much sitting in this honeymoon period. And I've been so chaperoned through the process by text, and I do acknowledge the hand-holding that occurred and the gentle words and the guidance and the introduction to a medium which was foreign to me except for as a reader, and the way that that's been enabled by people like Jane at Text and the whole team there. And so, yeah, I'm still very much loving it. So I'm kind of, I am still writing theatre, but a little bit begrudgingly.
Lovely. Well, they've answered the first question about enjoying the process of novel writing and writing more. I think it's a unanimous yes there. So I'll move to the next one. Jane talked about turning The Visitors into both a play and a book. Have any of the writers considered adapting one of their pre-existing plays into a novel because there was so much material they had to cut out when it went to production?
Yes. Yeah, I've got a play called Hibernation, which is about, it's set in 2040, and it's about the whole world going to sleep for a year because the planet has reached this point of ecological calamity, and so Earth rationalises, the human population rationalises, if they all go to bed for a year as enabled by a drug. I'm just stealing your idea. I promise this exists already.
It's all flattery. Go this, for it.
The planet will do what it needs, and then you see everybody wake up a year later and see what the world has become. It was really fun to do as a play, but now that I have a sense of this form, I feel like there is a compatibility between that story and this method. So, yeah, I would check that out.
I like the idea of writing another opera. I really enjoyed that process, and it was so beautiful. Again, theatre is really collaborative. Your director, your cast, your set designer, your costume person, they add to the storytelling. They're part of the dramaturgy of it. But opera was a different thing. I'm not musical at all, and so having a composer create the music for my story and take it into this whole different realm, that was really exciting. But, you know, I'm writing another novel in Rome as well. I've got a writing residency for 3 months, so I've got another novel underway as well.
Fantastic.
And I'm right now in the process actually of adapting an older screenplay of mine into a novel quite directly, because it's an idea that I still love very, very much. And, you know, film is just it's so expensive and the industry is so risk averse, whereas I think there's just more variety and curiosity in literature. So, you know, the kind of the pain, I think, of being a screenwriter is you spend all your time on what are essentially blueprints, you know, for buildings that never get built. You know, you can publish a play script sometimes, you know, but no one's just buying an unmade screenplay. So the joy of being able to give an idea of yours, a finished final form, is really, really meaningful and really beautiful. So I'm glad to have the opportunity to do that with some of my ideas now that maybe otherwise wouldn't see the light of day.
I'm with you there. The book is an object. Yeah. It's very important to me, and that I live amongst these objects. I live amongst these stories, and I can go back and find them and re-find them and all the time. So you've sort of we had another question, which was about why play to novel rather than play to film, but I think you've answered that one, Jordan. So yeah. And I know you're working on a film at the moment as well, Finn, aren't you?
Yeah, that's right. Doing some film, opera as well.
Opera as well. Fun. Fantastic.
I've got to get into opera.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, get into opera. It's the thing. Yeah. Enough of this punk music, really. Really. Please join me in thanking our three really fantastic panelists today.
You've been listening to Literary La Trobe, a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. To find out more, visit the La Trobe University website.